morning. Next on the docket, we have the matter of Merrill Lynch Mortgage Investors Trust Mortgage Loan Asset Backed Certificates, A18-1554. And as appellant and counsel, respondent counsel are aware, we'll have 15 minutes apiece and 5 minutes in response if you wish. And if you're ready to proceed, which it appears you are, you may proceed. Please identify yourself as well for the record as you approach the podium and any co-counsel you might have.
Good morning. John Orenstein for Appellant Procure LLC. I'm with the firm of Green Espel, and so I'm in about the same position as the Best and Flanagan attorney earlier, only I've only been in that position for 10 days. So
that's the firm. In other words, we should identify by your name. In other words, Green Espel.
That's correct.
Very good. Thank you.
I want to talk about the three issues that I think resolve this case in our favor. First, it's a legal issue, of course. Where a case is justiciable when it was filed, can a party render it non-justiciable by stopping what it was doing that gave rise to the case? Just a preview of my answer, federal law says presumptively no. You can make a showing that overcomes that presumption, but absent any other factors, the answer is no. State courts, and we cite 19 jurisdictions, follow this decades-old rule. There are no cases that we found or seen in our opponent's brief that go the other way. And in Minnesota, there are many reasons to believe that the federal approach would be followed here. The court has indicated that it would be followed here. This court has. And we think this is a case where the court ought to say that the voluntary cessation doctrine, if you will, of the Friends of the Earth in federal cases is the law in Minnesota. So that's the first question. The second is, how does it apply to the facts of this case? And that's probably the easiest question to answer because the only facts are the ones that we have put in the record through our petition. This is a 1202 motion. The facts are what they are in the petition for purposes here. Then the third issue is...
Can I go back to your first question, then you can continue on if you wish. Could we not simply look at it in a positive way from your client's standpoint that the petitioner was so convinced by the petition that your client, the declaration brought, that we shouldn't do what we're going to do, which in effect is what happened. In other words, a nice way to tell your client, well, they were just convinced, so your remedy is obtained.
Well,
ended.
That would be a factual issue, I think. It's a matter of drawing a factual inference to say, oh, I guess that NationStar has gone along with Procure's position.
Well, but, I'm just suggesting you tell your client that, but as a matter of law, you won.
Yeah. Well, yes, Your Honor. We didn't win because this is indeed likely to recur, and we don't want just that transaction to stop. Obviously, I wouldn't be here. What we want is a resolution of...
You say it's likely to recur.
Yes.
Where in the record, point me to something that can bear that out.
Sure. So that's my question. How do the voluntary cessation doctrines apply to this case? Here are the facts that indicate that this is likely, reasonably likely to recur. Let's use that phrase because that's what the case law uses. One, the trust was ripe for termination when this started, and it's just as ripe, if not riper, now. It was ripe for termination because the assets dwindle and dwindle. Their mortgages, they either get paid off or they get written off. And they dwindled down to below 10% of the original value. That was 2.5 years ago. So NationStar is still the servicer.
But just because they can do it, that's, to me, seems to be speculation.
Well, unless I can show that they have a practice of doing it and economic incentives to do so. And that's what our petition alleges. There is a pattern and practice of this. Trusts around the country in great numbers. And you know, one may say, well, we don't know if all of the trust agreements are the same. We don't know this or that. But we know that they collapse trusts regardless of what the trust agreements say. We allege in violation of what trust agreements say. And they do this because of a business strategy and strong economic incentives that drive that strategy. So the general behavior will continue. This trust fits the pattern. This trust fits the mold. And we know that the reason that it's not going forward here is because we brought the case, and I would say because it's still pending.
See, I would somewhat buy into that if this was the second go-round that you had to bring the case and there was history. But what you're trying then to have us support is that the industry history of how this occurs can in fact be transmuted to this particular case.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that having made that kind of showing, I think it's incumbent on NationStar to show something else. That's what I think the heart of these voluntary cessation decisions is. You don't have to wait and see if the party is going to manipulate the system. None of these cases say there's a history, well, almost none of these cases say there's a history of manipulation, and so we're going to not respect their cessation of their activity. Here, you have, if you will, a prima facie showing. And what does NationStar show in response? There are a lot of things they could have done. They could say, we're not going to do this. Or we're not going to do this for a year. And if we do this, we're going to give you adequate notice, more notice than you got of the price here, which was a matter of a weekend. They could say, we are going to, although maybe we don't agree with your interpretation, we will only do this in accordance with your interpretation of the pooling and service agreement, the trust document. There are ways they could have actually mooted this case. Instead, against the prima facie showing we made.
But you were looking for assurance from them then. I mean, that
something.
Essentially, what you want is a good faith showing that you can be more or less assured versus anticipating a negative action.
Well, I think they had to make some showing on the other side that given the incentives to go ahead, there's some reason to believe they won't go ahead. And all they have said in their papers below, in their papers here, and in their argument is, we might not, who knows what we'll do. That's different, I think, from speculation. Speculation is if something beyond my control may or may not happen. It might snow tomorrow. I don't know. But I might do this, I might do that. That's NationStar's position. And in the face of our allegation that they have this interest in going forward, that it's going to recur, that's not enough. That's the heart of these decisions. So, you know, then the next question is what I think is generally on a court's mind when it looks at justiciability. Is there a disagreement? Is there a dispute? You know, stepping back, are there definite and concrete assertions of right? And how does all that play out in a case like this that's not a suit for damages, but is more like a declaratory judgment action? It's a trust instruction proceeding. Well, in the papers that you see from NationStar here and in the papers below, they don't just say, we might do this, we might not. They say, the determination of the price has to await an actual transaction because the price depends on factors at the time. That's the very heart of our dispute. Our position, which our pleadings say NationStar disagrees with and which they obviously continue to disagree with, is that the price here was contractually fixed in September of 2016 when the trust fell below this 10% threshold. There's something called the initial option termination date. There's the option termination price. And what we say is that it's not a matter of what the facts are in 2019 or 2020, it's done. Over and over, NationStar disagrees with that, and they may even disagree with it. They may even express that disagreement today. Then there's the question of whether deferred principal balances are included in the optional termination price. NationStar says no. We say yes. The components of the price are what are at issue. And given the results of application of the voluntary cessation doctrine to this case, I think you have to conclude, yes, there's a dispute. They're disagreeing about these things. They're disagreeing about the trust instrument. And just pulling back when you're caught isn't enough to resolve that dispute, to take it away from the jurisdiction of the courts.
Mr. Ornstein, just getting back to the comment you made earlier, does the maybe you can articulate this in some way I haven't quite followed it yet. Does the justiciability require or obligate a petitioner to promise, to exert? Isn't it just a matter of whatever facts the trial court looked at, if there were facts and arguments based on the dismissal and already ruled that there's those exceptions don't apply? In other words, wouldn't it require, almost would require an evidentiary hearing for us to come to a conclusion, which we don't typically do, or ever do, on a justiciability? We just know that they withdrew, and that was the basis for your client's original action.
Well, I think that the starting point is, what's the record? And if the record is the facts in the petition plus the fact that they withdrew, the essence of the voluntary cessation approach is, well, the fact that they withdrew is not in and of itself dispositive, what the cases call mere voluntary cessation. So they could have, the judge could have called for a mini evidentiary hearing. There could have been limited discovery, and that's not unusual. It happens in standing cases. So somebody's a certificate holder, but as in the Group 1, Group 2 case, the unpublished decision that I think both sides cite here from this court, you can imagine that coming up with a trust beneficiary saying, hey, I'm an interested person, I'm a trust beneficiary. The trustee wants to know, well, let's drill down into that a little bit. Which group are you in, Group 1 or Group 2? There's a little factual disclosure, Group 2. And the case gets dismissed because Group 2 holders don't have interests in a Group 1 settlement. That's the case that was before this court a few years ago. That sort of thing could have happened here. If it requires facts, then you've got to develop facts.
Okay, so you have a situation that will likely happen again. So go to the second prong.
Okay.
How do you escape judicial review? If it happens again, you're going to do exactly what you've done. And don't you also have to show that it's something that can't be remedied in order to avoid the mootness determination?
Well, let me answer that in two parts.
I mean, it's burdensome. Litigation is expensive, it's burdensome, but it still would be subject to judicial review, would it not?
It, number one, what we're seeking here is an advance determination. So judicial review in a sense, but the question would be, can we get an advance determination? Because a trust instruction proceeding basically entitles us to do that. Now, if we get the same notice that we got here, then it could be, and let's just be clear what that notice is. Yeah. We got notice from the trustee that a transaction was going to take place. Nobody's obligated to tell us what the price is, and nobody did. So you don't really have the factual predicate to go in until you can say the price is going to violate the agreement. We learn about the price because the trustee posts monthly reports on the trust, and the one they posted a few days, actually two calendar days before this transaction, said that certain proceeds were being counted, and you could infer that it was from this kind of transaction happening, and you could infer what the price was. That's that notice. So, sure, we could go in and seek a preliminary injunction or a TRO once we find out what the price is, if we find out what the price is in time to do that. We could go in and say we think the price is going to be violative, but just think about how that works. So you have the right to a preliminary injunction, which is the right to a decision on a likelihood of success, not a full decision on the merits. It's possible that one side or the other would say custom and practice is important to this issue, or that the agreement is ambiguous, and so the intent at the time with respect to deferred principal balances is important to this issue. It's just not, I think, fair to say that, well, you'll be adequately protected because you can sprint into court again. That's what I think this voluntary cessation approach is designed to do with respect to allocating burdens. Yes, litigation is burdensome on somebody. It always is. But there's a live issue here. There's a trust that's ripe for the picking. And we think it ought to be decided. And I'll be back. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Ornstein. Respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honours. May it please the Court. My name is Tim Cameron from Cravath, Swain & Moore LLP in New York, and together with my colleague Katie Anderson of Stinson & Leonard Street LLP, we represent the respondent, NationStar Mortgage LLC, in this case. And let me say at the outset, I appreciate the courtesy of the Court in granting me pro hac vice status today to address you, so thank you for that. Your Honour, I think the appellant's briefing essentially concedes that under current Minnesota law, and indeed, the argument today, I think, just reinforces this point. Under current Minnesota law, this dispute, as it stands now, is properly non-justiciable. It is moot, it is not ripe, and there is no standing for it to proceed, and the district court found all three of those things entirely appropriately. For the same reasons outlined by the district court, and indeed, as reflected in Your Honor's questions this morning, we ask the court to affirm the dismissal that was made by the district court. Essentially, to prevail, the appellant here, Procure, is asking this court to do two things. First, to fold all of these justiciability challenges into mootness, and to mootness only. The argument that they make in their papers is that standing should be viewed as mootness, rightness should be viewed as mootness. That is not correct. These are separate justiciable elements, and they are all equally dispositive grounds for dismissal, as the district court found. And that secondly, in order somehow to overcome what is the plain result of an application of Minnesota law, this court should recognize for the first time, a federal exception to the mootness doctrine that the Minnesota Supreme Court has certainly had the opportunity to recognize before. Their brief makes clear, I think, on page 15 of the initial papers, that the Minnesota Supreme Court has cited to the Friends of the Earth case, which is the case, which is sometimes viewed as the genesis of this particular exception, no less than three times, but they have not explicitly embraced that policy. And one can only assume that that is because current Minnesota law on mootness, including the two exceptions that are currently recognized under Minnesota law to mootness, are both appropriate. There is no need, respectfully, for this court to recognize the voluntary cessation exception to mootness. And for the reasons explained in our brief, even if this court were minded to do so, that would not somehow make this case suddenly justiciable. Indeed, for...
I understand what you're trying to convince us to do, undertake the federal view of this, but we're an intermediate appellate court. I'm not sure in New York how that works out, but we're a reviewing court. What authority do we have to go ahead and embark on that new theory or policy?
Well, indeed, that's precisely my point. I don't think there's any need to. I don't think there's authority that suggests that this court should embrace this new policy. I think this court, much like the district court below, should apply current Minnesota law, which clearly finds that in a situation like this, where we had an optional contractual right to terminate this trust, that's not disputed. Notice was given regarding termination of the trust. A dispute then arose, and NationStar decided not to proceed. As Your Honor suggested, at that point, Procure, the appellant, got what it wanted. They wanted the preservation of the status quo, and that is exactly what happened here. As a result, they suffer no harm, no actual or imminent harm, no risk of harm, no prejudice. There has been no harm to them that is even capable of being redressed by this court or the district court at the current time.
Mr. Cameron, I assume there's not much dispute by the pleadings itself that there is indeed a difference of analysis of the purchase price, which, of course, led to the action and then the dismissal. At least I presume that to be the case. And so given the same language and we're at the same 10% level, I think Mr. Ornstein suggested it may even be worse, less than that. It has not gotten any better. So it certainly seems much more than beyond just speculation that at some point there's going to be, and that seems to fit more akin to the declaratory judgment, and I think that reference was made, where there's a certain amount of judicial efficiency in determining the party's position, so when that comes to fruition, it's a much smoother process. There's been a judicial determination. Would that seem to be the scenario, or if it's not, how would you differ from your analysis of it from, at least on their face, the legitimate concern it's going to come up at some point?
Well, and respectfully, Your Honor, I do differ with that, okay, because that is not, in fact, the case. At the moment, there has been no decision, and there's no contemplated decision, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that there will be a decision regarding termination of this trust. It is an optional termination right. It may never, ever, ever happen, and that was one of the points that the district court recognized. This is not a situation where there is judicial efficiency to trying to work out what is...
What I was trying to bring up, the whole judicial efficiency thing, because what I hear Mr. Ornstein arguing is that, you know, you could be like a gnat out there and you keep coming back and keep coming back, and the voluntary cessation doesn't fit, but what remedy would they have? Oh, I shouldn't be asking you that. I should be asking him. This was quite inartful. Let me state it this way. It seemed to me that they were looking for an assurance, Procure was looking for an assurance that you wouldn't be coming back within a period of time. Do you have an obligation to do that?
No, and I think that's the point. Under Minnesota law, under the normal law of mootness, if a party decides not to exercise an optional right, they're not obligated to then provide some sort of assurance or guarantee or covenant that they, you know, will not do that. They've made a decision. The issue that was specified in the original amended complaint has been extinguished. Otherwise, we would fundamentally change what we are looking for when parties to contracts are making decisions on almost a daily basis about whether to do something or not. Here, we decided not to proceed with the termination of the trust for business reasons. And that is it. It resolved the dispute. It resolved the controversy. There is no authority whatsoever, Your Honor, in the appellant's brief other than the voluntary cessation doctrine, which has not been recognized by this court, that imposes any type of burden on a party in the position that NationStar was in to somehow provide some assurance that it will never exercise an optional termination right. And that makes no sense here, where that optional termination right is purely optional and may never, in fact, ever be exercised. It is nothing more than pure speculation and conjecture that right will ever be exercised. And if it is, as the district court recognized, and indeed as my counsel for the appellant recognized also, there will be notice and an opportunity to come back to court. That is certainly the most efficient way to deal with this issue. But, Your Honor, I want to come back respectfully to the question that you asked about whether there's a difference in position. Absent a new notice of termination, absent a new setting of the price, That is utterly conjectural at this point. NationStar, there is no current notice in play. There is no current determination of price. There is nothing to say that first, if this transaction were to occur, that the notice or the price that may be specified might not be something that, frankly, Procure likes or can live with. That's the whole point. Unlike a declaratory judgment action, there is no, and I think in the words of the ACLU case that they talk about, you know, concrete assertions of right. There's been no concrete assertion of right on the part of NationStar regarding a particular price at this point. And that's why this is classically, quintessentially moot, because unless and until, and both of those words matter, unless and until there is a decision made to exercise this optional termination right, and unless and until there is a determination of price with which Procure takes issue, then we are doing nothing more than trading in possibles and hypotheticals, and the appellant is asking the court to issue a classic advisory opinion, which under McGaskill is not what this court does. This concept rings its way through not only mootness, but ripeness and standing. The idea of a concrete injury, the idea of redressable harm, none of that exists unless and until there is a decision to proceed with termination and there is a determination of price with which the appellant takes issue. As we stand here before the court, the record is very clear. The prior notice of termination was rescinded. As a result, the prior determination of price is gone. It is void. We could speculate about what NationStar may decide to do or may not decide to do if it one day at some indeterminate time decides to proceed with this transaction, but that would be nothing more than speculation at this point. And that even goes to the heart of the trustee instruction statute that Mr. Orenstein recognized. As the district court correctly found, it's not enough to just be a beneficiary, right? And this is the same for the declaratory judgment law in Minnesota. There has to be some idea of an injury in fact, some idea of imminent harm or something that the court needs to address. The declaratory judgment statute here, respectfully, is not open to just anything at any time. There has to be something that makes a declaratory judgment necessary. And at the moment, on the record before the court, that does not exist. Your Honours, I want to speak briefly. As I've said, I think it's very clear based on current law that this case is moot. There are no concrete assertions of right here. There's no dispute. There's no prejudice. There's no harm. There's no live controversy. And the point I was going to make about the declaratory judgment, they themselves cite to the declaratory judgment. They say issuance of a declaratory judgment, right, dealing solely with past conduct, would not be permissible because it would merely be advisory. That's what they are asking this court to do, to comment on a prior notice which is no longer in place. Ripeness, as I said, Your Honour, this case is not ripe because there is no controversy. There is no notice. There is no contemplated transaction. I think, as Your Honour said, they got what they wanted, which was to preserve the status quo and for this trust to continue. And then finally, Your Honour, we've made various points now brief about lack of standing, that it isn't provided for by statute. It also doesn't exist here because of a lack of injury in fact. And that exists not only in terms of the decision of the district court, but frankly, standing to bring this appeal where they are not an aggrieved party. Finally, Your Honour, the voluntary cessation doctrine. As I've said, it's not recognised under Minnesota law, and respectfully, there is no need for it to be here. Even if it were, this doctrine would not, respectfully, somehow make this case suddenly justiciable. The voluntary cessation doctrine is premised upon a course of conduct, and this is clear from the Friends of the Earth case, from a course of conduct, and the language of the cases that have applied it talk about things like ongoing conduct, you know, practice, things like that. Here, the conduct never actually happened. Secondly, that is voluntarily stopped in order to avoid judicial review. That is, again, utterly speculative. Third, there has to be a suggestion that it will happen again. And again, that is utterly speculative here. One of the cases that relied upon by the plaintiffs, the ACLU case again, says that there has to be a reasonable expectation of recurrence. That's a burden that they have to meet. And not just generally, but in this case. There might be a basis for that if I was unfortunately standing before Your Honours again having this happened once or twice or three times for this particular trust, but that is not the case. This was one optional right which NationStar decided not to exercise, and in the 14 months, I think we're now 18 months even since this issue was first addressed by the court, there's been absolutely nothing further. There is no proper showing here that there is a reasonable expectation of recurrence. And then finally, even if they could jump that hurdle, which they have not, we get to the point that was raised by the court about it still needs to escape judicial review. And there is no credible basis here for appellant to argue that if there is a subsequent notice of termination and a subsequent determination of price, that they will somehow be deprived of the opportunity to hail us back into court and fight whatever issues they wish. That's how our legal system works. They say that the notice that is provided doesn't have price. I'm sure that they will be able to monitor the trustee's website, and if a notice pops up about termination, they would be able to reach out and inquire. That's, again, how our system works. This is a contract that was negotiated between sophisticated parties, commercial parties, and that contract enabled us to either exercise this right of termination or not. And that's exactly what has happened here. Respectfully, Your Honour, there is nothing here that is different in any way, shape, or form to normal business, to normal transactions. There is nothing that makes this the type of conduct that was in the Friends of the Earth case sufficient to recognize, or necessary even to recognize for the first time, some new type of exception to mootness under Minnesota law, and to somehow keep what is a quintessentially moot case live for further determination by the district court. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Mr. Ornstein, you may respond if you wish.
Thank you. It's not.
And would you also address the federal voluntary cessation document? I put that question to Mr. Cameron, but I just don't see how we could, as a reviewing court, can apply that.
Let me start with that. The voluntary cessation doctrine is not an exception to mootness. It is an answer to the question: can a party moot the case by stopping what it was doing? Now, can you take the federal approach? Yes. This court has, as I think counsel said, relied on Friends of the Earth, not for this specific proposition, but it's a little peculiar to say that Friends of the Earth is good for other justiciability determinations, but not this one. Friends of the Earth has been relied on for justiciability in Minnesota. And the Mankato Township case, non-precedential, did state and cite federal authority for the voluntary cessation doctrine, indicating that this may well be the law in Minnesota, but it's non-precedential. Certainly, the case didn't say this isn't the law in Minnesota, or we're not sure about this, or express any controversy or doubt about it. So it's not beyond the purview of a court to recognize that this court, to recognize that the law of mootness includes the proposition from Friends of the Earth and its predecessors that you can't just moot a case by stopping, not without more. Now, Mr. Cameron says the burden is on us and our suppositions are purely speculative. No, the burden, even if the burden were on us, our record makes a showing of likelihood of recurrence. And there is zero on the other side, other than assertions by counsel that this was a business decision, that nothing is presently contemplated. Nothing is in the factual record to overcome what we've put in the factual
record.
Mr.
Ornstein, one final point Mr. Cameron made I wanted to get your response to is that you've got sophisticated parties with contractual language which was agreed upon, and obviously part of that, the surmise of that then is if you had wanted greater notice or some different type of notice or assurances before the implementation of that option, the parties could have contractually agreed to that. Why wouldn't we just stop at that point, that that notice is the notice, and so if it happens with, if it happens, you will indeed have a remedy, the same one you started with?
Well, because contracts are also made in the context of the law that exists at the time. And when this agreement was made, the Minnesota Trust Instruction Statute existed. So everybody knew that you have the right to go in and get a determination if there is a dispute as to how this agreement applies and what it means. And that's where we are. There is a dispute over how it applies and what it means. Council seems to indicate that the disagreement is speculative because the price hasn't been determined. But I'll say it again, that's the whole point. The price is determined. The price was determined 2.5 years ago, and council insists on saying that, well, the price might be something else in the future, depending on future events. That's the live dispute. The contract has determined how much they have to pay when they collapse this trust. I think that we're dealing with a combination of the voluntary cessation doctrine being misapplied as if somehow it only applies to really bad conduct, which is most certainly not the case. It applies in all kinds of disputes, and we cite a contract dispute in our brief. There's that, and the standard on Rule 12 motion that was violated here, because the types of assertions that you heard today from NationStar were taken as facts as if they were part of the factual record. They are not. Our factual record says there is a reasonably likely chance of recurrence. They have not met any burden of showing that there isn't a reasonably likely chance of recurrence. And finally, you can't cabin and narrow this situation to what happened in this particular trust. There is a pattern and course of conduct. So I don't think it's fair to say, well, this has only happened once. The essence of our petition is that this is happening and we need to get in where we can. And this is where we got in to try to put a stop to it. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Council, for your comments today, and we'll take the matter